come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
And our guest today is going to be Sol Vang. He's the author of the new collection of poetry titled
To Live Here. It's a fantastic book of poems that tells a little bit about himself and a little about the Hmong experience. And I don't know if you're very familiar with the Hmong people, but it's really a fascinating, fascinating book. And of course, he's also a Fresno poet,
which means
I like him immediately because I'm from Fresno. Tim's from Fresno.
That's right.
The only one not from Fresno is Norma Martinez, our producer. But we like her anyway because she's so brilliant.
That's right.
So, yeah, stick around. Sol's going to talk about his new book and he's going to read a poem.
That's right.
So we received... The literary community received some really sad news recently. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at the beginning of this year, author, novelist, poet, humorist Michelle Cerros passed away. She had been battling cancer for about, I think, over a year and a half maybe.
Yeah, and she was so young and so... What amazes me about her is as she was dying, I'm a Facebook friend, and I know you are too,
right.
But as she was dying and she was in the hospital and she was going through chemo... She would post these pictures of her with big smiles on her face, and she was just always so positive, and she shared so much, and it was just amazing to see how she was going into this ordeal with such a positive attitude and open heart, and
she
full
was,
of love.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Full of love, and she's always been really a warrior, you know, for youth, for herself, for women, for just sort of, you know, for culture in general, for the literary arts. She's always been really sort of on the forefront of that, and fearless in everything that she approaches in terms of her writing. And I don't think she's ever, you know, at least in my interactions with her, she's always kind of looked at the world and life through that lens of humorist and seeing that way. So I could see her, you know, towards the end of that struggle as she was posting things, you know, I could see that sort of humor still there, very present in who she was, yeah.
And Michelle Cerros is best known for her two very popular books, although she has many more. One is called How to Be a Chicana Role Model, which is a hilarious, very influential book. I think after that book, a lot of Chicana writers, new writers, were incredibly influenced by her.
Right.
And the other one is Chicana Falsa.
Chicana Falsa.
Those are her two most famous books.
Yeah, that was the first book I read of hers that introduced me to her work was Chicana Falsa. And I laughed the whole way through. And after that, I said, I want to do that, which I've never been able to do. But
yeah, and I didn't know her personally. I know you did, but I didn't know her personally. I mean, I met her a few times. And like I said, we were on Facebook and we communicated with each other occasionally over the Chipotle cup incident. I had contributed a story to that. But when I first moved to El Paso, she was doing a reading at Barnes & Noble. I think Chicana Falsa had just come out. Yeah.
Really? Wow.
And so I went to go see her, and she was like one of the funnest readers I've ever seen in my life. She had this game where she would like ask you at the end of her reading a question about what she read, and if you got it right, she'd give you a prize, like candy or something like that. But one of the things that she said that just had a profound effect on me as a writer, she said that when her book came out, she put boxes of it in the trunk of her car and drove from city to city promoting the book.
That's right.
And I thought, damn, that is a, you know, what a writer needs to do, you know, to really believe in their work.
Yeah,
and
she was pretty, she was really business savvy, you know. I mean, I got that, I think I met her when she was about 30 and I was like 21 or something like that. And, you know, she was already very business savvy even then. She talked about how she had put these books in the back of her trunk. She managed to land herself on the Lollapalooza tour that was happening in the 90s. She was a spoken word poet. So she was traveling around with all these bands backstage reading poetry from these big stages with thousands of people, you know. And then later on, she became a writer for the George Lopez show.
Right.
So she really sort of got her way. She found her way into the sort of back door, window, front door, however she could get in. She really, you know, she was just really savvy that way.
Yeah. Well, Michelle Cerros, wherever you are, thank you so much for bringing your beautiful vision, not only to the writing community, but to everybody.
Right, for being an influence and a mentor and sort of just a champion for all of us.
You know what might be a good idea
sure.
is to read something by her. I see you have her book there. Can you read something? by
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. In fact, this is the first publication of Chicano Farsa ever. Yeah, man.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow, first edition.
That's first edition, yeah. I bought that at a store in Long Beach, one of the stores that she took her box of books from the trunk and dropped it off at.
Chicana Falsa and Other Stories of Death, Identity, and Oxnard. Yeah. That's a wonderful title.
And she says, we would never tell people that we lived in Oxnard. We'd say we lived between Malibu and Santa Barbara.
That sounds much better.
Yeah. This poem is called Annie Says. My tia Annie told me you could never be a writer, let alone a poet. What do you know? I mean, what can you write about? You got a D on your last book report. You got to be able to write English good. Use big words, and you've never been out of Oxnard. Writers travel all the time. New York, Paris, Rome, every place they make oil of Olay. That's where writers go. That's where they live. Your family doesn't have money to travel. You never will. And you don't even type. Now, how are you going to be a writer? Sure, some famous poets say they write longhand, but that was long ago, and they were men. Men have it so easy, those worthless, lazy dogs. But you wouldn't know about that because you've never been with one. You never ate, slept, inhaled pure passionate love. And writers, they're always in love. Like this Harlequin romance I'm reading, see? Now, how are you going to be a writer? You don't even like boys yet. You've never given your heart to a boy so he could take it, hold it, clench it, wring it dry to toss it away forgotten in the gutter. They make you cry, hurt, suffer, and writers know stuff like that. They heal their pain with words. You don't know about pain, anguish, outrage, protest. Look, look on TV. The Brown Berets, they're marching. The whole Chicano movement is passing you by, and you don't even know about that. You weren't born in no barrio, no tortilleria down your street. Bullets never whiz past your baby little head. Chicana without a cause. No, mija, nobody will ever buy your books. So put your pencil down and change the channel for me. It's time for As the World Turns.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Shel Cedros.
We'll be right back with Solvang on Words on a Wire. Solvang, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much, Daniel and Tim. I'm very glad to talk to you and to share my book.
All right, your book is called To Live Here, and it's a collection of poems. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, the book is, the core of it is my MFA thesis. And for the last 10 years, I've been adding to it. And so now when someone reads it, it reads like a poetry collection, but also I think the part C is almost like a memoir. And I didn't mean it that way, but it just turns out that way.
And not only is it a memoir of Solvang, who lives in Fresno, the poet, but it's also a memoir of, in many ways, the Hmong experience.
In some way it is. When I first started writing, I felt like I was the only Hmong writer out there.
Right.
20 years ago. So, there was very few Hmong writers. And so I felt like, I have to write about the Hmong story, too.
Right.
About history and our experience and our flight and our assimilation into the U.S. And so in some way, I think it's kind of pretentious, but I love the poems.
Totally not pretentious. You're from Fresno, and,
right.
and people in Fresno know a bit about the Hmong experience. I was at the a community college 3-4 days ago registering for this class I'm taking in HTML, and the lady at the window saw my book. I was carrying To Live Here with me, and she goes, "What is that?" And I told her, "Well, it's a book of poems by a Hmong American poet," and she goes, "What is Hmong?" She had no idea. And I think a lot of people don't know, that don't live in Fresno or St. Paul, Minneapolis.
There's a big community in Denver also, actually.
Denver, yeah. And Merced.
Right.
A lot of our listeners may not even know that it's spelled H-M-O-N-G. Can you tell us a little bit about, give us an orientation to the Hmong community for those of us who may not know anything about it?
Sure. The Hmong is ethnic minority in many countries like China, Vietnam, Laos. And we, as far as we know, lived in China and in the last couple of centuries, and we gradually moved into Southeast Asia in the last two centuries or so. And in the 1960s, the U.S. was trying to stop communism in Laos so that it doesn't spill over into Thailand. So they decided to recruit the Hmong to be a secret force to fight in Laos. And so we fought for 15 years stopping communism from reaching Thailand, and Vietnam War concluded. The U.S. pulled out of Southeast Asia, and so the Hmong, as a result, had to flee because they were decided with the U.S.
Some of the Hmong community came to the United States, but another sort of section of the community also went to France, right?
Yes. After the war, the Hmong in Laos actually fled all over the world to the U.S., to Canada, to France, to Australia, Argentina, and many other countries too.
And a lot of the community went to Fresno, which is in fact, doesn't Fresno have one of the largest Hmong communities in the world?
I think actually Fresno and California has the most the largest number of Hmong in the U.S.
Well, it's a fascinating book. It's a fascinating narrative of not only of your life, but of some of the history of the Hmong experience. How did you get into poetry?
I think when I was younger, I had some inkling that I wanted to write, and it was more a dream rather than a goal. And in some way, I wrote a little bit here and there, very general, very amateurish poetry. But when I went to the Omni and I came back to college, I took a class in poetry in my senior year. And so as a result, I really felt attached to it. And so my teacher, Chuck Hansley Chuck, I said, why don't you apply for the MFA? We're starting the MFA this year. And so he was the director, and he just basically just invited me to the program.
At Fresno State, you got your MFA at Fresno State. You were one of the first class to receive the MFA, huh?
I think it was probably the first or second class.
Wow, that's great. You said, Sol, that when you first began writing poetry, you felt like you were one of the only Hmong poets around at the time. And I know that that's not the case necessarily anymore. You're part of a founding member of the Hmong American Writers Circle. Can you talk a little bit about that group and what it's meant for you and the Hmong community, I think?
Sure. The Hmong American Writers Circle was founded by Burley Vang and Andre and Ying and this younger poet who came along probably like 5, 10 years after I was in the program. And so, you know, I was already graduated. I was working. I was writing less. I was going by my normal life. And so these guys were going to the program, interest in writing. And so they invited me to join their group. When I met them, I was very excited because here were these young guys who were very articulated, very thoughtful, and very enthusiastic about writing. And so, you know, I felt like I had met my brothers, you know. And
right.
So. And basically, they kept me, they sustained me, and they pulled me along. And so I haven't stopped writing the last 10 years because of them.
Just to put it in context for our listeners who may not know much about the Hmong tradition, what is the Hmong literary tradition itself?
We have mostly oral history. We have a form of sung poetry that usually used during New Year's or during courtships, where girls and boys or men and women would sing to each other, and one would sing, the other would answer back, and then we're back and forth for hours and days even. And so far, this is one form of it. There's another form that's almost like Western poetry, where it rhymes. The last word of the line rhymes with the first word of the next line.
Hmm. Have you ever experienced that poetry as a child?
I heard it. I have heard it. I was starting to learn it, and I was starting to be interested in courtship and all these things. But then when I was 11, we fled Laos, and basically didn't have any more chance to learn, to practice this traditions.
So we're talking to Sol Vang, whose new book is called To Live Here. It's a book of poems. Sol, how old would you say the written Hmong language is? How old is it?
It was in the 1950s. It was devised and was helped to put together by a Catholic priest and some Hmong. So in the 50s, it was started, so maybe 60 years or so.
60
wow,
years.
That's
wow.
Amazing.
And that makes the Hmong American Writers Circle and yourself sort of a vanguard generation, right? I mean, being the first ones to publish in a sort of written form, right?
Yeah, I think we are, you know, like you said, the vanguard. Our anthology, How Do I Begin, was the second one. It was the first one that was published in 2012. Yeah, called Bamboo Among the Oaks, and it originated in Midwest, in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And so that was the first one. Basically, I think we are on the front.
And the anthology that you guys at the Hmong American Writers Circle published, they used the title of that anthology is the title of your opening poem, right? How Do I Begin?
Yes.
That's great.
The publishers chose that title because they felt that, you know, it in many ways connect to the Hmong writing.
Yeah.
So I imagine if the language is, like you said, 60 years old and was... I guess originally began to be transcribed by a priest, that it uses so-called Western characters in trying to phonetically capture the words.
Yes, the Hmong language originally was very rich in poetry because it is oral, so you have to do mm-hmm. a lot of reading, a lot of metaphors to kind of make sure people remember them. And those devices are used in the language itself in almost everything that we spoke. Every sentence that people speak would rhyme or would have two things that go connect together, and it's like a pairing of words.
That, you know what this reminds me of? This idea that, before there was much written language, before there was much opportunity to print texts and to distribute them among the people, poetry was memorized, and mm-hmm. poetry was told around campfires, or well, not campfires, but told around the fireplace. But there was a part where poetry and fiction split up, but it used to be that's how you delivered stories. You delivered them through poetry, through rhyming, because rhyming was easier to memorize. And so these great stories that come from almost every culture were split in two. But what's interesting is because the Hmong language has only been around in the written form for about 60 years, I'm wondering if there's more of a inclination to tell a story, to tell a narrative in the poetry that Hmong writers are producing today.
In some way, that's true. But in some way, we have really lost the rich tradition of the oral. The language that the elders use, the rhyming and the coupling words and the ideas, we have lost that already. So the younger people who speak Hmong nowadays are using more of the common, just very, very mm-hmm. basic English. But we have actually lost that tradition.
I like that your poetry also addresses that, right? The distinction between generations, right? You sort of the newer generation of Hmong writers, or the first generation anyway, you know, and then the tradition. And then I think it's really well addressed in your poem, Shaman Poet, where you talk about sort of the parallels and distinctions, right, between the Hmong shaman and the modern Hmong poet. You talk about that generational gap. How have the elders, I guess, in your community received your book? You know, received the work of all the new Hmong writers that are coming out?
I think they have been very supportive. I think they see this as a new form of telling stories, and a form that we have to adapt to and learn to use, because the oral tradition is fading away, and so we have to really nurture and create and guide and help young writers along so that there will be more and more of our stories written down. And so I think this trend is going to be more supported.
You know, Solvang, the way I would think of you is as a Fresno writer. You're one of the Fresno poets, which is really kind of a wonderful group of poets to be among. And I noticed that some of your influence are Corinne Clegg Hales, who was a fantastic poet in the faculty at Fresno State, Chuck Hanzlicek, who you mentioned as an early influence, and Philip Levine. How do you think Fresno has affected the way you write?
I think when I first started writing, my teachers were Connie and Chuck. And so I never had a chance to.
I love Connie. She's like the one. She was my very first teacher. I would not, you know, I know we always say this, but I would not be a writer if it wasn't for her.
You're a brother writer then. Because I feel like my writing is very similar to Connie's. Very earthy, very basic, you know, very narrative. Mm-hmm. I never had a chance to take the class from Phil or. But I feel like a connection because he was there at the school. And so I hope he didn't get offended that I cite him as an influence.
The hell with him. That's what he would say. He would say, the hell with him. Who cares what he thinks? And maybe you're lucky you didn't have him because he was notorious for being really, really mean. Corinne, she's a wonderful teacher, but she's also incredibly nurturing. But Levine, he's like known for saying stuff like, "All right, you see this word in your poem? Keep that word and throw out the rest."
Yeah, in some ways that might have helped me because I feel like I need some harsh.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And everybody who's taken him, you know, except for those who couldn't handle it, said it was one of the best experiences they've ever had, and they've learned a lot.
Now, Sol, you were also a U.S. soldier, right? And if I'm correct, you spent some time here in El Paso at Fort Bliss, right?
I did. I was in the Army for a while. After high school, I went to college, and I was kind of drifting. I was kind of lost in some way because I think. I had a period in my life where I didn't know who I was, what I was going to do with my life, and so forth. So I was in college for 2 years, but then I dropped out and I joined the Army. Mm-hmm. And I went to Germany, and then I ended up in Fort Bliss, and actually not in Fort Bliss, El Paso, but they sent me out to the White Tent in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Half an hour to get back into town. So basically spent a year out in the desert.
Yeah. Right. And a lot of that experience is in this book, to live here in your book. And I'm wondering, you know, I guess something I'm just kind of curious about was, were you writing these poems during that time that you're actually in service, or did you write them sort of afterward once you had gone through it?
Yeah, I write most of the poems when I got back to do poems and went back to college. So they're more like a reflection back. Yeah. I wish I had written some of those poems when I was going through the experiences, but at that time I didn't have the skills or the craft to start writing yet. So.
Well, you know, that experience is evoking another Fresno poet, Brian Turner,
right.
You know, the soldier mm-hmm. poet who's
right.
been on the show. And now that you're a poet, I mean, you've always been one, but you have a book now. One of the first things that we learn when we have a book, especially if it's from an independent press, and if we're not Stephen King, that we have to go out there and really, really push our book. You are the first poet that I know of that has went to a flea market to sell his book of poems. Can you tell
That's
us
awesome.
About that experience? I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
I did. During the Fresno New Year, I went out there, and a friend had a booth, and I went out and put my books there, and then I sold them at the Hmong New Year, which
Hmong New Year, right.
thousands of people came by. And, you know, a lot of people came and looked at the book. Some bought a copy. And a lot of people who bought it were just people that I knew and who know about the Hmong writer circle,
right.
Friends through friends. And so it's a good experience to see how interested people are and what they think about the book and so forth.
And, and then you said that the churro vendor next to you had more luck than you did, right?
He did.
So you guys should have struck up a deal.
Yeah, your churro in a book for a special prize.
So I think you have to really make poetry more appetizing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's a sweet poem.
That's right.
The value of doing that, of course, may not be in the number of books that you sell, but just in getting your name out there and so that the community knows that you're there.
That's right.
Are you incredibly active in the Hmong community where you are?
I am, and not too active, but I have been involved in a project that called Hmong Story 40, where we are trying to collect stories and artifacts and experiences together. And next year, we're going to put a showcase in Fresno, Merced, and Sacramento. So I've been this year, I've been a little bit more involved with this project. And so I've met a lot of Hmong, very active Hmong people who want to participate in this project.
Great.
I met people who want to tell their stories. And so it was a very good experience for me.
Well, it's a beautiful collection.
Yeah.
We both were awed by it, and we're talking about it before we called you. Can you read a poem from this for our poem of the week?
Which one would you like me to read?
Well, personally, I like the little Mexican boy in Walmart.
Chino, but, yes, I agree. That's what I was going to suggest, was that one,
but,
Chino.
You know, whatever
I
you
like
want. Well, Tim likes it too, so
I do.
How about
yes.
Chino?
Chino?
Yeah.
Okay, sure, I'd love to share Chino. Chino, in the aisles of Walmart, I bump into a Mexican boy, maybe 6 years old. He looks up long at me in fear, it seemed. Then he puts his fingers on the outside corners of his eyes and pulls out and up, clamping his eyes. Chino, Chino, he said. My hand reflexively swung to wipe out the little superior smile from the bold brat's face. But I took hold of myself. I scrutinized the boy. His handsome face, a blend of East and West, was glowing, happy almost. I wanted to say to him, yes, little brother, my eyes are slanted and rather beautifully, I think. And yes, I'm a Chino, and so are you. My ancestors came from the land that would become China, and so did yours. My many times great-grandfather and yours, they probably played and rode through the vast steppes together as boys. Maybe they were even cousins who cried on each other's shoulders when yours rode east on the land bridge and mine was left behind.
That was Sol Vang reading Chino.
Chino.
Thank you, Sol, for being on Words on a Wire.
Sol, it's been a pleasure.
It's a fantastic book. I hope everyone orders it, and good luck with the next one.
Good luck, Sol.
No, thank you so much. Thank you for helping me spread the word here.
We'd like to thank our guest, Sol Vang, for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Yep, it's been fantastic. Sol Vang, good luck with your book, To Live Here.
And we would like to dedicate this show to Michelle Cerros and for her great contribution to
literature,
goodness.
To humor, and to goodness, right?
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Join us every week on Words on a Wire. And the next book you read,
it could save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tightrope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top arrow.